Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea. This is the Cuckoo's Nest Broadcasting System presenting the Jerry Roach Show.
Bro.
And good morning, Tokyo. Well, here we are today, tonight, whenever you're hearing this, we have Mike Patton from Middle Class, a very influential band from the beginning, you know, like these guys were there before anyone, and they influenced a lot, and it was Mike Patton, the bass player, who also produced the Adolescents, their first album, that great blue album, had Amoeba on it, as well as Kids from the Black Hole, and just a great, great record.
And China White and the Minutemen.
Oh, you produced the Minutemen too, huh?
And Christian Death, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like you're the Geza X of Orange County. He seemed to have produced all those bands up there, you know, in the beginning. He was right there at the Mask, and, you know. But, and you played the Cuckoo's Nest many, many times, too. I was looking through my booking calendar, and do you remember any of the specific shows?
I have. There was one show that was that we have recorded, and so there's a couple of songs that Mike Atta released on a Middle Class kind of compilation thing he did about 12 years ago. Huh. And so I kind of remember it wasn't really, it was about half full, you know, the crowd. Mm-hmm. You know, the sound's really, you know, kind of harsh and, you know, one instrument's way too loud, but it's, you know, it's still cool. Anyway, the energy is right there. We weren't that technically proficient. So, and we probably didn't do a sound check or something like that. So we just got on there and it just wasn't balanced, but that's, you know. Yeah, it's punk rock, you know, what the hell?
I think because of the stage being in the corner helped that because of, you know, the way the sound bounced around.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it was hard to hear in there.
Yeah. And we were talking earlier, Eddie in the subtitles, he's still around, huh? He's in Reno?
Eddie is in Reno. Yeah, there was a time I thought he was, had heard that he had died. And so I thought he was dead for a couple of years. And then... I don't know how somebody said something and I started pursuing it and it turns up somebody contacted me on Facebook, I think, and he runs a radio show out in Reno.
Really?
Or maybe not it's a radio show and he also does like horror movies like on the local TV. So he's.
Yeah, I was surprised when I asked you, is he still alive? And you went, yeah, no. Because that was one that I figured wouldn't be still here.
Well, and I got, I know, yeah, you would. I got his phone number and I actually called him up and he picked up the phone and we talked for a while.
Speaking of phone numbers, I remember one time he was booked to play like on a Sunday night and he didn't show up, you know. So I call him and I go, Eddie, what the hell happened? He goes, oh, I forgot. I'm going, Eddie, you got my number, right? And he goes, yeah, lose it. And so then he gets interviewed, which is a great line. I loved you. So then he gets interviewed, and he goes, Jerry Roach, you got my number, lose it. And I'm going, that's my line, Eddie. But I always thought he was like an older guy that was selling drugs to the kids, which
well,
was probably true.
I met Eddie. Middle Class played Santa Ana College, probably 1980, you know, early 1980. And... there was nobody there. You know, there were like five people there, and Eddie was one of the people. So he talked to me afterwards. Now, at this time, Mike Atta had a girlfriend, and Jeff had a girlfriend, and Bruce had a girlfriend. So the band wasn't hanging out. We were playing and stuff, but then they were going off and doing stuff. So so Eddie goes to the show, and he talks to me afterwards, and he goes, well, you know, what's going on? Is anything happening? I said, oh, there's a show in LA tonight. I wanted to go, but I don't know if I can. And He goes, well, I'll drive. Let's go. And so
that's
I went, okay. So I met him. So we go up there and, you know, I'm talking about being in a band, not making any money and whatever. There was nobody at the show. So after we go out, we're coming home and Eddie says, hey, I got to stop by my house. So he stops at his house, runs in, comes back out, starts driving me home. And when he gets to my house, he gives me $100. And
wow.
And he said, pay me back when you're a rock star.
Wow.
And I just went,
how cool.
This guy's fucking cool, you know? So what Eddie wanted, and Eddie hung out in San Francisco back in the, you know, with Quicksilver Messenger Service.
I knew he
Jefferson
was from
Airplane.
Another era because he was like more like almost my age.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean.
So, and that was really cool. And what he wanted was to be in with the in crowd,
uh-huh.
you know, and I was in crowd.
Yeah.
And
I always thought he was separate. He didn't like, he wasn't like one of you guys, but he was one of you guys, but he was like separate.
Oh, definitely. And so his story, and when I first was hanging out with him, he was married to this lady named Michaelin, beautiful, you know, nice lady. And Eddie had just inherited a bunch of money. So he was real kind of into middle class and what I was doing. And so he wanted me to see his band. So he had a whole studio in his house and all these amplifiers and stuff. And so I go and watch his band, the Subtitles, and they were terrible, just terrible. And so Eddie's talking to me about it, and I just went, that is some goofy new wave, you know. And so next time we're together, he goes, Mike, I fired my band, you know.
On your say-so.
And I went, oh, really? Wow. And he goes, but I've got some shows. And so, you know, you got to help me out. And can you play with me? You know, we're, you know.
Oh.
And so I felt bad that he fired his band. So I said, okay. And I talked Bruce Atta into playing as well. So we played.
So you were the Subtitles.
So we were the Subtitles. But Bruce bailed like after two shows. So Eddie took me over to where this band called Tubaflex Brothers was rehearsing. And Matt Simon played in Tubaflex Brothers, and we started hanging out. And then he got into the Subtitles.
Well, that's a great intro. We got to play something by Eddie now. So what do you got for us?
Well, the American Society, that's the signature song.
Well, let's hear it. Here it is, American Society, Eddie and the Subtitles.
Go on the ground.
That was Eddie in the subtitles, and we're talking to Mike Patton here, middle class producer extraordinaire of the early scene. Oh, you said you were in Santa Ana. Is that where you guys are from?
Yeah. We grew up in Santa Ana.
So did I. I grew up in the South Santa Ana by Memorial Park.
I was Flower and Edinger.
Oh.
Basically right there.
Yeah, that's... Well, you're a little further down from... Yeah, I know right where that is. Yeah, I went to Mater Dei, St. Anne's.
Okay, yeah, we went to St. Anne's. I went to Saddleback, met Jeff at Saddleback High School.
Oh, you're kidding. I didn't know that. You're Santa Ana homeboys. Yeah. I always figure you're from Fullerton or something because you were always with the adolescents.
Well, we ended up kind of gravitating to Fullerton, but... Yeah. And that was through Eddie, actually, because we started rehearsing. I mean, Eddie provided a rehearsal place. And I mean, he just, he always had drugs. He'd take us out to, you know, to lunch, buy us pizza. We'd go out, go see Apocalypse Now, whatever. It was a really pretty crazy 2 year.
Well, I liked Eddie. There's something about him that I liked. He's just hang loose, always smiling. And it's just that, you know, when he forgot that gig, it really made me mad. But that was towards the end anyway, I think.
He collapsed pretty good. I mean, he kept going for a long time after I kind of stopped. He recorded a couple of albums.
And I never got that name either, subtitle. Oh, well. On to...
Yeah, well, it was a stupid new wave band.
Oh, that's
And that it. Was... But that was the name. I never told him to change the name. I never cared, you know? He would have if I had told him, probably.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to be hip. He wanted to be, you know, punk rock was cool, and he wanted
and
to
he
be
wanted to find
accepted.
Out about it, yeah. And it's hard to do that coming from, you know, being
it's
older.
It's sort of it's a kind of an organic eruption, you know.
Well, I remember the dawn of the hippies and how everyone had this feeling of our thing, and that was what I could see that in the punk scene. So I knew it was something really strong, and it was pure and small. But for someone outside the scene to hey, what's going on, guys? You know, and I had no idea. It took me forever. I'm still figuring it out. Because I'm like an old Rolling Stones guy, you know, and Rolling Stones, Beatles, Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix.
I'm amazed that it's still going on. I mean, you still see punk rockers. I mean, they, you know, when at a show, you know, they'll be young kids and, you know, 50-year-old guys. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, Geza X said that it was skateboarders that kept it alive. And, like there was a lull after the Cuckoo's mm-hmm. Nest, not to be that important. But I kind of dropped out of the scene. In fact, they thought I was dead too for a while. But so I really don't know much what happened afterwards. But evidently there was a lull. And he said it was the skateboarders that kept it alive. And I think they were the guys that started the slam dancing and that stuff. Did you know that started at the Cuckoo's Nest?
Well, you'd mentioned that. And that's cool. I don't know. I don't know who comes up with these things, but...
Well, the guy that did American Hardcore. He's the one that told me. I never thought of it, you know, until he said that.
He told me I was in the first hardcore band. So there you go.
There you go. Well, he did the research, I guess, and he got a ton of money to make that movie.
Well, we were pretty early.
Yeah, that, actually he bought some footage from my movie to, I think he opened up his movie with it, with Black Flag.
The one thing, it's a bummer, there's no film of middle class back then.
Yeah.
You know?
There wasn't much of that, you know, video was such bad quality back then anyway.
Yeah.
That's when I made my movie, I shot it with black and white film, which now it looks archival, you know, it looks like, it's pretty cool. Have you seen the?
I have not seen it.
Or Urban Struggle? Did you ever see that one?
Mm-mm.
That you can see that on YouTube. Actually, that's we put that out there. It was only like 32 minutes long, so it's doesn't get boring. You know,
that movie American Hardcore was. I thought that was well done. Mm-hmm. I liked how they showed. It beginning and spreading.
Yeah,
I mean,
kind of
that
the
was
history
really,
and all that.
Really interesting how it grew.
But I like that part of it. But like all these movies, they get kind of boring after a while.
Well, I mean, the the hardcore thing is kind of limited.
And even the decline, decline that inspired me to make my movie, because I thought, well, I could, you know, it's not that hard.
Oh, well, that's not that good of a movie.
I thought the decline wasn't, you know.
Well, all it's that, just, you know. I mean, that's such a, that certainly wasn't my my vision of what punk rock was, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of, it played up the.
There's this image that kind of, there was an intellectual element to what was going on.
Yeah,
it got kind of diluted when the HB thing and the real, you know, macho testosterone stuff really started going. But there was always this understood observation of the world and how fucked up it was, you know. So. That was
well. You know, in the beginning, I learned not to book Huntington and Fullerton at the same time. But after a while, it all ironed out. But
which is of course so stupid.
I know.
I mean, it's when punk rock exploded in Orange County or got caught on in Orange County, the IQ dropped, and you had, because it was much more of a high school thing, mm-hmm. and these high school guys and that whole rivalry and the the kind of gangishness of it.
Be true to your school.
Really was stupid, you know? But that's what happened.
That's kids, basically.
Yeah.
Tribalism, whatever. But I remember watching how at first it was style and different clothes. And then, but somewhere along the line, I guess with the advent of the mosh deal, you know? You know, the press started writing about it's violent, and then violent people go, hey, that's for me.
Well,
it attracted the violent people.
And it was, you know, at the beginning, there were, you know, you look at the crowd, and it was guys and girls, and they're all hanging out, and they were moving, but they were all in the crowd. Eventually, it was all guys with their shirts off, going around, and you couldn't see any women. They were nowhere to be seen because it was so, you know, violent and, you know, what the hell is that? I mean, it's weird. It was a very, you know.
I don't know how it evolved to going around in a circle, because the Cuckoo's Nest days, they didn't go around in a circle. They just kind of came together, you know.
Yeah, you just bash into each other.
Yeah, but there was, I don't know when that happened, like I say, because I kind of dropped out after the Cuckoo's Nest.
Well, there's all these rituals. It's pretty funny to watch, you know.
Yeah, there were the arty people, the nihilists, the violent people, the
well, and the we lesbians. Weren't really, and we felt separate from that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we lived here and we played and we were part of the scene, but we weren't part of that. We weren't really part of Fullerton either, but we liked those guys, and so we kind of adopted that.
I kind of associated you guys with Fullerton, and then Huntington was like, you know, TSOL and those guys,
right?
The Vandals and
right,
you know, what's this? China White, definitely. I like those guys. They played a lot of shows too.
Yeah, I produced that album.
We just did a special on them when the poor guy died. They didn't have a lot of material, but we managed to play it all, I think.
Oh, that's good.
You know, like a memorial show. So what should we play by China White? I think Danger Zone.
Danger Zone's their hit, right?
Yeah, let's play Danger Zone.
Amazing.
That was China White. We were just talking about the Alley Cats. There's another band that doesn't get a lot of recognition, but they were there. And you said you just saw one of the guys?
Yeah, actually, they're reformed, and they played in Fullerton Sunday night at, I forget where it was, but yeah, it was really good. They sounded great, and Randy sort of was rescued. I guess he was kind of lost, and people rediscovered him, and now he's out playing, and that's really cool.
Oh, good for him. Good for him. So what should we play by the Alley Cats?
By the Alley Cats, probably Nothing Means Nothing. That's I think that's their best song. Nothing Means Nothing.
Nothing
anymore.
Means Nothing. The Alley Cats. Randy, take it away. Alley Cats, we're here with Mike Patton, talking about their early days. You know, Alice Bag, we talked about her earlier. The first ever punk show in Orange County was a benefit for The Mask for Brendan. And I was just curious about it, so I thought, well, what better way than to have a show? So I did a benefit.
Really? And you did a benefit for The Mask.
Yeah, and he brought four bands down, and I gave him the door. And the bands were The Controllers, which I think later became Wall of Voodoo, or a band called Alice Bag, and The Skulls, and another Steeman Freeman, who was a saxophone player that I think that was probably his only gig. But Alice Bag, the controllers and the skulls. February of 78. That was the.
Wow. I don't think I heard about that show.
Well, it was the very first one, and it was, like I say, a benefit for the Mask. And then from that time, I think what Jim Trash.
Well, we were going to the Mask.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean.
How long could he have been open? He's got one entrance. I mean, you can't have a nightclub with one. I mean, that's.
Well, it was an underground.
Yeah,
thing.
Way underground, huh? It was like rehearsals.
We were booked to play the Mask, and we were booked. The Sex Pistols played Winterland, whenever, and we were going to play the Mask the next day.
Mm.
So we go to San Francisco to see the Pistols, and we see them. And when we come back and we show up the next day to play, we're told that the Mask is closed. So we're like, fuck, you know, we were going to, you know, Middle Class was going to play the Mask, which was the, you know, I mean, it was the Cavern Club. It was the place. And so then we're hanging around, just, you know, hanging out. And two guys from the Pistols showed up. So they would have been in the audience to see us play. It was like such a bummer.
Which two?
Steve Jones and Paul Cook.
Who was that other guy that was with them at Sid Vicious?
Sid Vicious.
Took his place.
Glenn Matlock.
Yeah, he played at the Cuckoo's Nest with Iggy Pop.
Really?
Yeah, he was in his band.
And Mike Watt is playing with Iggy now.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah, what a fucking great gig.
Yeah, yeah. That is a good excuse. We can play Iggy.
Search and Destroy.
You want to hear that?
Yeah.
Okay, here it is, Search and Destroy with Iggy Pop.
I'm a street-walking cheetah with a hat full of napalm. I'm a runaway son. A-bomb. I am the world's forgotten boy, the one who searches and destroys. Somebody gotta help me, please. Somebody gotta save my soul. Baby, that's late for me. Oh! Look out, honey, 'cause I'm using technology. Ain't got time to make no apology. So radiation in the dead of night. Love in the middle of a firefight.
Good old Iggy. I remember I Want to Be Your Dog. That was pretty punk. He was one of the first guys,
Oh, well, he was the godfather before.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was, you know, what he was doing was just out there. But that was
like
way.
He smashed his face with a microphone and bleeding. Yeah. At the Whiskey, he that was a legendary show. What a character. He's from Detroit, Motor City, or that area.
Yeah.
And who was it? Chuck Tukowski thought the MC5 were important for that.
MC5, and then the Stooges, New York Dolls.
New York Dolls.
I mean, they were, you know, probably play something from the New York Dolls.
Yeah, that's my favorite. David Johansen's one of the friendships I forged at the Cuckoo's Nest that I value today. He's a great guy, and I always like seeing David. By David Johansen, well, obviously Personality Crisis, but I was thinking, well, let's play Personality Crisis.
It's a great song. Yeah, you can't beat that.
Personality. That was David Johansen, my pal from Staten Island. I remember he told me he wished he had a cuckoo's nest in Staten Island. And I had these matches, and I made up locations on the matches that weren't, well, there were actual cuckoo's nests, but I didn't own them. You know, like there was one in Canada and one in Mexico. And they were basically like nightclubs inside restaurants, kind of. But I put them on my matches. So when it came time for new matches, I put Staten Island on there. I sent him a box of matches so he could have a cuckoo's nest. And we, for some reason, I put Honolulu, Hawaii, and I felt bad because so many punks came up to me and said, we looked all over, we couldn't find. But, yeah, that was one of my sick joys, lying on the matchbook and lying about my age. You know, I always said I was 33, but I was really like 40. Eddie was probably 33.
Yeah, he was probably mid-30s.
Yeah, yeah, he was a little younger than I was. But like I say, I was too old to be a punk rocker. But eventually, you know, we were far apart, but eventually we kind of came together when the shit came down, kind of, you know, when was interviewed every 5 minutes. I would try to say stuff positive about him and defend him, you know, because nobody else was.
Well, he kind of burned the bridge he was standing on. I mean, it was, yeah. I'm the guy that narked on him.
Oh, on Eddie?
Yeah.
Oh, what do you mean? When?
Well, he was. He had taken the Adolescents' money to record the album, and they had, and he spent it. You know, he didn't record the album.
Oh, that's when he crashed, right?
And I was like, yeah, we were out for pizza and he was laughing and he goes, yeah, you're eating the Adolescents album.
Oh.
And I'm like, that's not fucking cool. I mean, one, I'm supposed to produce this album. And two, the Adolescents are nice guys and they're trusting you and you're, you know, that is not cool. You can't do that. So I called Lisa Fancher and I told her. And so then.
She's Frontier Records owner.
So then pretty soon Eddie was like gone and we went in the studio and recorded the album.
Yeah, you have to you can't do that kind of stuff and keep moving. Not for long anyway.
I mean, Eddie was a good guy and that was not cool.
You know, speaking of those days, obviously the biggest song that came out of that time was Amoeba. And I remember Tony telling me KMET was playing it, and it really exploded, and that's right when they broke up. But let's hear Amoeba by...
great song.
The Adolescents, produced by Mike Patton, who's our guest tonight.
In our lab, looking through the microscope, the little glass eyes, they never lie. How can this fall my cope? I've never seen anything like it before. This amoeba's got a mind of its own. But don't turn your back to stupid science world. This is reaching for the telephone. It's alive. You're better off dead if you only knew your current life's taking a dive. I've never seen anything like it before. This amoeba's got a mind of its own. But don't turn away, you stupid science world. This is reaching for the telephone.
Was Amoeba. I remember them playing that at the Cuckoo's Nest one time, and Tony introduced it with Something Always Happens when we play this song, and it was jammed that night, and they went into Amoeba, and it was the only time that the whole place started moshing or slamming. The whole place, it went off like a gas fire. I mean, back by the pool table, there was nowhere that they weren't getting into it, and I remember it was a magic moment. Thank you, Adolescence Ivory. One of my good memories of the Cuckoo's Nest. But
and the other, in my opinion, signature band from that part, I don't know if they're a Fullerton band, but is Agent Orange.
Oh, yeah.
And
I think they are considered Fullerton.
Well, I know that when before any of the Orange County, just before Orange County hit, Al from Flipside, I would write occasional articles for Flipside, and Al asked me what was going on in Orange County, and I said nothing I know of, and he said, well, actually, I'm hearing that there's these bands, why don't you check it out and write an article about it? So so he gave me some contacts, and I contacted these people, and they, for a couple of weeks, I just went to all these parties and saw all these bands that were underground, hadn't played any shows yet. And by far the best band was Agent Orange, and the Adolescents weren't together yet, but Agent Orange had Steve Soto and Casey, I think, in the band. But so
Casey was in every band. He said he was in the original Social Distortion, and he never mentions the Adolescents. I think they had a riff of some sort because.
Absolutely. There's very bad blood between the original members, you know, all of them.
All of them? But what a bunch of talented guys. I mean, they had the Agnews, Casey, who's a, you know.
Well, that sounds.
He's a personality, Casey, more than, you know what I mean? He's
good guy, really fun.
Yeah. Know? Oh, never a dull moment.
All this, you know, positive energy, you know.
But and then Tony and Steve Soto and I mean all these guys are still playing today and contributing. What a bunch of creative, of creativity there.
And Steve is actually living on it.
Yeah.
I mean he's. I mean most of us. I mean I didn't play for 20 years, but.
You had to find another way.
You know, and most everybody is working a regular gig, and then, you know, if they're still playing, then they come out and play. Which is fucking right, better than just working a regular gig.
yeah. Well, it's something to look forward to.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, that's got to be, you know, you've got to just be willing to sacrifice, you know? And you can do that, you know, you can't do that when you have, like, a kid or something.
Yeah,
know?
He's got a family. But he's been, like, my buddy Blondie, you know, he's been playing with lots of, you know, he played with the Beach Boys and the band and... And the Rolling Stones.
That's pretty big. So you can make money doing that.
He toured with the Rolling Stones for 10 years, just singing backup.
Really?
Yeah. I got to meet Keith, hang out with Keith.
Now that's rock and roll.
Yeah, that was so fucking great. You can't believe it.
Rock and roll.
I got lots of Keith stories. which I probably told most of them on the air here, probably.
That's cool.
Not really, not all of them. I just remembered one today that I never told anybody about. I was watching this show Stoned on TV the other night about Brian Jones, and it reminded me of something. Oh, I remember Keith complaining about Anita, you know, how he got her straight and then how she fell off the wagon and how frustrating it was. You know, I think it's because I had somebody like I was dealing with. But anyway, yeah, we're pals. We hit it off at the same age and everything. So
yeah, that's cool.
And luckily enough, we just, you know, hit it off. So he always requests that I show up when he comes to LA, when my buddy goes.
That is cool. Yeah, I'm sorry I missed the, like, I just missed the period when, you know, Iggy played the Whiskey and the New York Dolls were playing and, you know.
Yeah, it was before your time, huh, by a few years.
Just missed it, yeah. You know.
Yeah, I used to go to those shows like that. I remember all about Iggy. I used to manage a guy named Mike Bishop. I don't know if you know him, but, well, he was in, what was it, John Q. Public. And anyway, through that, trying to get him a deal and making demos and shopping that stuff, that's how I stayed kind of in touch with everything after. My first bar was 1970 in Newport, the Bacchus House. Oh, I think we were talking about that earlier.
Yeah, we were talking about that, yeah.
We had no idea what, but you learn the hard way when you've got to be open every night. And eventually people find you. I booked Bo Diddley in that joint. That was one of my, I think that's the first big act I ever booked. And that was exciting. I remember I hired this band to play, he wanted a backup band, you know, it was like him and Chuck Berry, they show up with their amp and want the cash before they go on and get some local band to back them up. And that's the way they did it in those days. They make the most money and the less cost. And I had this band practice for a month. I remember my electricity went up $100 that month, just the juice they used practicing. And they had 18 greatest hits. So they got on stage, and they were just kids. They weren't great musicians, but they knew those songs, you know. So they got up there and go, okay, what are we going to play? Bo, we're all ready to go. And he goes, just funk it up. And they go, we don't know that one. And so it was really awful. I remember just dying 1,000 deaths, and, you know, nobody noticed. Because Bo was strong enough to come out and overcome it.
Be sure to tune in next week for the conclusion of Jerry's interview with Mike Patton.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea. This is the Cuckoo's Nest Broadcasting System presenting the Jerry Roach Show.